Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh and one of the women accusing him of sexual assault testify before the Senate yesterday, and politicians here in New Hampshire respond. A third voter faces charges of voting both in New Hampshire and Massachusetts, and State Senator Jeff Woodburn, facing charges of domestic violence, claims he was acting in self-defense. These and other stories made news this week in the Granite State, and we will round up the news for you in this hour. What questions or comments do you have about the week's news? Call into The Exchange. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website NH Political Capital. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here.
Good morning.
Hey, Peter.
So we're going to spend some time in the first part of the show talking about yesterday's Kavanaugh hearings. You'll also hear conversation about the Kavanaugh hearings elsewhere on NHPR today. So we're not going to spend too much time on this, but we will spend some time. We want to get your thoughts if you have them. And now is the time to call if you'd like to comment or ask some questions about it. The phone number for you to join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. So our senators responded yesterday and today. Maggie Hassan tweeted yesterday, quote, in Judge Kavanaugh's initial hearings, he showed a lack of truthfulness on a range of issues. Today's testimony, referring to yesterday, only reinforced my questions about his credibility. The Senate should halt this confirmation process, and there should be an FBI investigation. Senator Hassan was on the Senate floor on Wednesday offering her reaction to the Kavanaugh nomination and the subsequent reaction to Christine Blasey Ford's allegations.
It is simply unacceptable that survivors are still not being listened to and taken seriously. And to President Trump and Republican leadership, I say we will not stand for these attempts to silence women and shove them back into the dark. Mr. President, these allegations of sexual assault are extremely serious, and they are credible. The way that these survivors have been attacked is disgusting. Yet even before we were aware of these allegations, it was clear that Judge Kavanaugh should not serve on the United States Supreme Court.
That's Senator Maggie Hassan speaking on Wednesday. In a statement, Senator Jean Shaheen said, quote, Dr. Ford's testimony was detailed, moving, and credible, and I believe her. I was in awe of her bravery and strength today. I hope her testimony will be a watershed moment for our country for survivors of sexual assault. Women all across the country are making their voices heard and demanding change when it comes to the treatment of women and sexual assault survivors. That's the statement from Senator Jean Shaheen. And she spoke with NHPR this morning. She says, without an FBI investigation, yesterday's hearing undermined the Senate Judiciary Committee and the confirmation process.
I hear from people who are concerned about the process, who are concerned about the country, about the divisions within the country, and the fact that this has become such a partisan situation on the Judiciary Committee with Supreme Court nominees when it never used to be.
That's Senator Jean Shaheen. You can hear the full conversation at nhpr.org. Democrats seem to be aligned behind Blasey Ford 100%. What may be more surprising is Governor Chris Sununu's response. He said, and a story written by the Associated Press, that Blasey Ford's allegations are serious and should be fully investigated. He also said through a campaign spokesman that the Senate, quote, should think carefully about the next steps in this process. Want to get to our panelists in a moment, but listeners, again, now's the time to call if you have a question or comment, 1-800-892-6477. So we'll go to you first, Dean Spiliotis. What do you make of Governor Sununu's response?
Yeah, it's interesting. We've had a couple of Republican governors, Governor Sununu, but also Governor Baker of Massachusetts, Governor Scott of Vermont, the Maryland governor, where a lot of these events that were discussed yesterday were said to have taken place, all call for some sort of FBI investigation. I'm not sure exactly what Governor Sununu meant by the Senate should proceed carefully, but nonetheless, he is out there making a statement that saying that these charges need by Dr. Ford need to be thoroughly investigated. You know, my expectation is that this is going to be a partisan line vote. Republicans only need 50 because then Vice President Pence could break the tie. I have no expectation that Senator Shaheen or Senator Hassan would vote in favor of the nominee. You know, maybe Joe Manchin, the Democrat from West Virginia. I know President Trump is doing a rally in West Virginia this weekend, which will put even additional pressure on Senator Manchin. But we're looking at a largely, assuming that the nomination is moved out of committee this morning and they're going to be meeting, I think, within the hour, we'll go to a floor debate and it's going to be a very narrow party line vote. One question is retiring Senator Jeff Flake from Arizona, who is really the one question mark on the committee this morning. He has not said how he's going to vote. Maybe he has in the last few minutes, but he has not, as far as I know. He could, in theory, vote to move the nomination to the floor and still vote against the nominee, but we're just not clear where he is, nor are we sure where some of the more moderate Republicans like Senator Collins, Senator Murkowski from Alaska, where they are either on this. We're waiting to find out, but it's going to be a pretty close vote. You know, governors have no direct role in nominating or confirming Supreme Court justices, but it certainly adds to the larger political environment, and it certainly can have implications for a fall reelection campaign. Certainly,
Kevin, what do you think?
Yeah, I think Dean's points are certainly well taken. I was struck by the fact that you couldn't find anybody really in public life who didn't say Christine Blasey Ford was credible with her testimony, and that's fairly striking. And I think that's what made Judge Kavanaugh's job that much more difficult in the afternoon. It was clear he'd gotten his marching orders from President Trump to be more forceful, to push back more at Democratic senators. He interrupted many of them. Later apologized to one woman senator after kind of badgering her in a back and forth that they had had, and that left an impression. Both New Hampshire senators don't serve on the Senate Judiciary Committee, so they don't have any role in today's committee vote. They certainly will when the issue comes to the floor. I think Governor Sununu's statements are reflective of how good a job Dr. Ford did in her testimony. You could see what made the hearing particularly riveting at the beginning was you could see her visibly trembling while she was speaking at the beginning of the hearing. She got much more comfortable and I think more self-confident as it went on. And it was clear her lawyers wanted this structured with these five-minute questioning periods in a way that so that the hearing didn't draw out too long. And I think that probably helped her as well.
And it's fascinating to view what we saw yesterday in the larger context of what's happening in the country. Right. Certainly the impact of the Me Too movement on people being willing to come forward and talk about sexual assault or sexual abuse or misconduct, and also the bitter partisanship in the country. You know, Judge Kavanaugh's remarks in the afternoon were, for me, certainly reminiscent of Justice Thomas's remarks over 20 years ago. But he overlaid on top of that, accusing Democrats of essentially a conspiracy theory to withhold this this information from Dr. Ford and kind of sandbag the nomination once he got through the initial set of hearings you know, 10 days ago. So just a remarkable, for me, remarkable set of connections to the larger political environment in which we're all trying to make sense of this now.
Listeners, if you've got questions or comments, again, please do call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. And let's talk to Cindy in Concord. Cindy, thank you very much for calling.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
So I just wanted to say that, first of all, I disagree a little with as far as his character. I think that I just wanted to say what's really pointed out to me with his Kavanaugh's performance and all of the things that we watched yesterday is I think we're missing a teachable moment here. And I brought this up to Jean Shaheen's office this morning. The conversation I had with my 12-year-old daughter was about the fact that, you know, here's a man who, like all of us, is human and who's done some things that are probably regrettable and that he's not proud of, like going to rowdy parties when you're younger. And I, what I really wished that I would have seen from someone who's going to sit on the highest court is that he would have owned that and acknowledged it, and that he would be using that teachable moment to talk not only to his daughters, but to all younger people about the dangers of binge drinking. And it's not that I never did it or anybody never did it. The point is that you have to acknowledge and talk about something that's meaningful and helpful and propels the conversation forward. I guess, disturbed by the fact that there's so much focus on the he said, she said, because I don't think we're ever going to know. I believe her, but I don't think we're ever going to know what really happened. But what bothers me more about his character is that he was defensive and flippant and minimized that type of behavior and that type of pattern of behavior. And no one's talking about what we want our kids to know and what kind of person we want making those sorts of decisions on the highest court, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I appreciate your comments, Cindy. Teachable moment for parents. I imagine people who have young children who may hear snippets of this may be asking their parents questions about, you know, what does it mean to drink that much? And why is that bad? And what could it do to your mind if you drink too much? I don't know if you have heard any conversations like that, Dean.
Yeah, interesting. You know, there's been a discussion on social media since yesterday about whether or not his anger and his temperament as on display yesterday was justified or not. Obviously, whether or not people think his behavior was justified yesterday splits pretty cleanly down party lines. But, you know, I think people who were upset with his performance, as Cindy pointed out, you know, felt that he was evasive on some of his on sort of the reality of his behavior in high school and college. Now, he may or may not think that's disqualifying, but you know, some people felt like he was a bit evasive on you know, the true nature of his drinking. And, you know, when they went over the high school yearbook stuff, he gave explanations that, you know, he's just a couple years younger than me. And I remember a lot of those terms from the early 80s. And some of what he explained was not accurate. And either he either lied or he just couldn't remember. But in any event, you know, something that could have been a moment where he could have sort of talked about it openly and honestly, he missed an opportunity. You know, whether or not that's enough to deny him a Supreme Court seat, people can debate that. But Cindy's point is well taken. I think people who are unhappy with his performance yesterday, it was more about kind of the temperament on display, the way he answered some of these questions, the way he treated, you mentioned, Senator Amy Klobuchar, whose father is a recovering alcoholic, and he started asking her about whether she had ever had alcohol to the point of blacking out. It was just kind of an inappropriate and sort of flippant way to address a senator. I understand emotions are high. There's a lot at stake. But, you know, we have a long history of discussing judicial temperament in this country. And, you know, Republicans will say, well, he was pushed to the point of displaying that anger and temperament. Democrats would say that was a problem in and of itself.
Let's talk to Celia in Brookfield. Celia, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I was struck by the statement that Judge Kavanaugh made about this being an attack on his character funded by, I don't know if I'm using exactly what he said, but left-wing big money or, you know, funded by the left wing. And I'm concerned because nobody called him on that. I don't know where he got that information. And is there any information that points to that?
Good question. Thank you very much, Celia. Kevin, have you heard anything about a left-wing funded campaign against Brett Kavanaugh?
That's certainly been the narrative from the Republicans. You could tell from some of the questioning from the special counsel that the Senate Republicans had. Rachel Mitchell, she kept questioning Dr. Ford about who paid for the polygraph, who paid for all these flights you were taking.
Right.
They were pushing a narrative that somehow left-wing groups were supporting Dr. Ford and were behind her speaking up and coming out as she did publicly, kind of so late in the process.
In fact, they were going even beyond that and arguing that she was really a pawn of these left-wing forces who they saw an opportunity to kind of use her to sandbag the nominee, as he said, at the last minute when the regular hearings were not sufficient to derail him and getting, you know, and there also were a number of televised ads that opposed him, just as there were ads that were supportive of him.
Let's take one more call on this. Let's talk to Sharon in Newington. Sharon, thanks very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
My question basically is that the chair of the committee said, you know what, we used our full power. We investigated this, seeming that that was just as good or better than what the FBI would do. And I'm just curious, how much did they investigate, and is that just as good as what the FBI would do?
So what do you think? How much did they investigate?
Well, you know, the Judiciary Committee has Republican and Democratic staff. They referred to them during the hearings as minority and majority staff. Obviously, Republicans are the majority staff. They do investigatory work. They do background work. It's not quite the same as a seasoned professional of the FBI. And then there were some discussions about whether or not Democratic investigators were included on certain calls and whether or not the Republicans on the calls pushed and probed Judge Kavanaugh sufficiently. So the whole point of the FBI is to kind of lift it out of the partisan context, although, you know, President Trump has kind of brought the partisan context to his critique of the Department of Justice. So it's just it's a little more opaque than maybe it once would have been. So there was a process of vetting. There are Democrats and Republicans involved in that vetting, but it's different than having the FBI. There is an FBI background check. And in fact, Judge Kavanaugh mentioned that over the years and the many sensitive positions he's had, you know, four or five or six of these kinds of investigations. The question is, as was the case with Justice Thomas many years ago, when the new evidence came up from Anita Hill, they reopened the investigation for a bit additional time in order to do some more research. And that's what the Democrats were asking for yesterday in the hearing. And obviously Republicans said, you know, this was a calculated ploy to derail the nomination.
Listeners, NHPR is going to be following this story as it develops throughout the day and throughout the weekend. So stay tuned for updates on the vote, if there is a vote, on Judge Kavanaugh's confirmation. You are listening to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. So let's talk about another story that was in the news this week. A UNH student was charged with voter fraud for allegedly voting by absentee ballot in Massachusetts and in person in Durham. Kevin, this is another case of someone voting in both New Hampshire and Massachusetts and was found out using the program known as the Interstate Voter Crosscheck Program. What do we know about this student?
This student was attended the University of New Hampshire. Spencer McKinnon is his name. He was found to have voted both in UNH in Durham on Election Day in 2016, but also voted by absentee ballot in Dracut, Massachusetts. And as you point out, it's really the cross-check program that determined this. This is a third case. Last week, Attorney General Gordon McDonald announced indictments of another couple who had voted both in New Hampshire in Hampton and also in North Belchertown, I believe it was, in Massachusetts as well. Secretary of State Bill Gardner has indicated that There are another 80 cases he's referred over to state prosecutors for them to further investigate this matter. There's a lot of – the cross-check program has been very controversial nationally. A number of Democratic groups feel it's ripe with problems, that it produces a lot of false negative results that are unfair to voters and end up discouraging people from voting. But New Hampshire remains in the program and will continue to investigate these matters.
Mm-hmm. And have we heard Spencer McKinnon's side of the story?
We haven't heard his side of the story. Haven't been able to reach him for his comments about why he did what he did. It's in New Hampshire, it's a Class B felony, which carries a prison term of up to 7 years, although I don't think he has to worry about that kind of punishment. But New Hampshire certainly has, as we know from the 2016 campaign, voter fraud was a great narrative after the election about Trump insisting that he lost New Hampshire narrowly because of the number of fraud cases, which have not been substantiated. But Secretary of State Gardner agrees that there are a lot of people, both in New Hampshire and nationally, who need to have faith in the process of voting, and that many of them are skeptical that everybody's vote is valid.
Though, and no indication, of course, that this has been timed to be so close to the midterm elections, but sort of an educational point for voters out there to say, hey, you can't vote absentee somewhere else and then vote in person here.
Yeah, it's true. We don't know the rationale, whether maybe they thought, well, I can, vote for the national candidates here and then vote for my local back home candidates absentee, or if it is a more intentional move to defraud the system. You know, this cross-check program has been criticized, and I think it marked initially flagged something like 95,000 cases. They've whittled that down to like 130. So you get to the larger critique by President Trump that millions of people were voting illegally. Got 130 cases in New Hampshire that are under investigation. Out of how many people voted in 2016 here? 700,000, 700,000, maybe more. It's a very small percentage, but certainly in local races in particular, when things may be decided by a handful, you want to be as accurate as possible.
And is there any indication that more of these cases are on the way? We just heard about one last week. A couple in their 70s voted this way as well and were charged.
Yeah, I think it was the reverse, where they voted absentee in New Hampshire and voted in person in Massachusetts. I don't have a sense exactly of this 130, how many have been prosecuted. But it seems to me like it's just kind of an ongoing process of going through them.
Kevin?
Yeah, and certainly Attorney General Gordon McDonald has created this kind of public election integrity unit in his office. He's given it high priority, and I suspect there'll be other cases brought forward.
All right. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we're speaking with our guests about the week's news, of course, as we are wont to do here on the Roundup. And still to come, we're going to be talking about State Senator Jeff Wedderburn. He's facing domestic violence-related misdemeanor charges, and he is claiming self-defense. We'll talk a little bit about that, and we'd love to hear your questions or comments about this or anything else in the week's news. So give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or if you prefer email, the address is exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Knowing what's happening in the midterm elections before you vote in November is important. But what about what's going to happen in December or January? Hi, I'm Lauren Chulgin, politics and policy reporter for NHPR. When you give each month as a sustainer, you help NHPR and NPR cover the entire election. What happened before, what's going on now, and especially what's coming next. Be a part of what comes next. Become an NHPR sustainer today at nhpr.org.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar at SNHU. Give us a call if you have questions or comments about the week's news. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. There's been a new development in the case involving State Senator Jeff Woodburn, who has been facing domestic violence-related misdemeanor charges. Kevin, can you bring us up to date on these?
Yes. Former Senate Democratic leader Jeff Woodburn, lawyer, basically filed some documents this week. It was the first real attempt by that we've seen in this case by Woodburn to try and mount in public a defense for against these domestic violence related charges were brought against him when he's arrested in August for having engaged in inappropriate contact with his former partner. And essentially in the documents, Woodburn insists that he's claiming self-defense, that essentially a lot of these confrontations he had with his now former fiance were the result of attempts by him to end the relationship, that she became very belligerent, according to him. He's been accused of an assortment of conduct with these nine different misdemeanor charges, biting a woman on the hand and a forearm, striking the victim with his hand in the face and stomach, kicking in a door that led to her home in Jefferson. And in response, he's essentially saying in almost every case, he was responding to her aggressive nature against him. The documents claim that at one point she brandished a knife against him. They're also trying to his lawyer is trying to obtain the counseling records. These two had counseling sessions as they were having difficulty with their relationship. And according to Woodburn's lawyer, these records are going to affirm his defense. According to Woodburn's lawyer, the counselor at one point reached out to Woodburn and essentially warned him that your fiance at the time is going to retaliate against you based on statements she's made to me. And we've seen also that the alleged victim in this case has actually told state prosecutors that she'd been upset at Woodburn about the course of their relationship mm-hmm. and had taken actions against him.
And these are all sort of allegations at this point.
Right.
And if I could take a broader view of this, first of all, should mention that the victim's attorney has sort of called what you're describing, the moves by Woodburn, as sort of a smear. But
also the victim's attorney's really upset that the documents actually name the victim in this case, and that the request for these counseling records, these documents that name the victim, should have been done under seal in the court, according to her attorney. Mm-hmm. And that by not doing that, Woodburn's attorney may have violated federal privacy laws.
There is a concern here about what's talked about publicly for this case involving very private matters. Of course, when a politician is involved, stuff happens publicly. Dean, what are the ramifications for the parties involved when stuff like this becomes public and discussed right. the way we're discussing it now and it's been discussed in the press this week?
Right. And I think, you know, Kevin did a good job of laying out the legal issues about sealed versus unsealed and what's in the public domain and what people should have a right to know given his elected position. You know, the larger political context really is quite remarkable. You know, Jeff Woodburn has been a key figure in the Democratic Party in the state for many, many years. Kevin and I have had lots of interactions with him in a political context. He was the leader of the Democrats in the state Senate. He's now essentially a pariah in the party. Every member of the caucus in the Senate, except for Lou D'Alessandro, said he should resign. Now, he gets his day in court. Maybe his reputation will be rehabilitated and he'll be proven correct in his self-defense claims, but we just don't know yet. And so we go into November with a big question mark about whether or not he'll even be able to hold this seat. The attempt to have a write-in candidate in the Democratic primary kind of fizzled, so he gets to be the nominee in November. And that district, has the possibility to go either way. But he had been a very well-established politician for many, many years, and it's just kind of shocking to see the quickness of his fall from that position.
Well, let's talk about something else that we now know going into November that may have an impact, and that's a few union endorsements that we learned about this week in the gubernatorial race. Both major party candidates received endorsements. Let's start with the one for incumbent Republican Chris Sununu. He received the endorsement of the Professional Firefighters of New Hampshire. Dean, what's the significance of this endorsement?
It's a very nice endorsement for the firefighters for Governor Sununu. It's the first Republican that they've decided to endorse since Craig Benson in 2002. They've been pleased with kind of his overall willingness to kind of put forward, you know, kind of move their legislative agenda on things like insurance, I believe, for cancer and a number of other issues. And so that's I don't know whether that was a surprise or not to Democrats, but it's a nice get for him. And he seemed in the press conference, he seemed quite pleased. They had shirts made up and signs, and they were good to go. And anytime you get, you know, there's debate about whether or not endorsements really matter in terms of changing people's minds, but they certainly, having these types of organizations behind you for things like get out the vote and phone banks and getting people to the polls, it's a nice thing to have in your pocket.
And though they haven't endorsed a Republican for governor in quite some time, they do often endorse the incumbent, right, Kevin?
Yeah, they do. And we see this in New Hampshire a fair amount, which is to say public employee unions overwhelmingly support Democrats, except for law enforcement unions and the incumbent governors. This incumbent governor seeking a second term also has a state troopers union in support of his candidacy, and also the police association, which is made up of local police unions, not all of them, but a number of them across the state, rank-and-file police officers, that union supporting Sununu as well. They supported Craig Benson, the firefighters did back in 2002, and actually in 2004. And that's what the Democrats point out this week. They don't always lead to victory. Obviously, in 2004, they supported the incumbent Republican Governor Benson, and he lost re-election. But I think Dean is right. If I'm the incumbent governor of either party, I want unions supporting my candidacy. If I'm a Republican nominee, it's a nice pushback to a Democratic candidate. And these firefighters, they're among the most politically active union in the state. It's worth noting, as we'll talk about, Molly Kelly this week announced the support from the State Employees Association, which is probably the second most politically active union in the state, particularly in primary politics. Firefighters can make a real difference. The State Employees, as we know, it's the largest union in the state in the public sector or in the private sector. It's the biggest, with representing more than 11,000 state employees in New Hampshire, and they can have a great impact, particularly in a general election, because, as you might expect, even though they're members of a union, a lot of state employees were put in state jobs by Republican governors over the years, and so many of them aren't liberals or Democrats. Many of them are Republicans, so this union support can really help you in a general election.
And was there a part of Kelly's platform specifically that the State Employees Association liked, Dean? Do you know?
Well, they've said they have generally been pleased with her particular voting record. They certainly were unhappy with Governor Sununu with the state contract negotiations, and they've been generally supportive of Kelly's positions on a number of social issues, education, and other types of social programs. But I think a lot of it was probably driven by animosity over that contract negotiation.
Okay. Listeners, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Give us a call if you have questions about the week's news. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. Let's talk about the ACLU of New Hampshire's lawsuit filed Tuesday against the Exeter Police Department. The suit alleges that officers arrested a man based on his suspected immigration status, and the man was apparently working as a translator for the police. But when that job was over, when the man who they were investigating was arrested, So was the man who was helping the police. That's the long and short of it, right, Kevin?
Right. This particular man is Jordanian. He married an American woman, as you point out. I think one of the reasons why the ACLU got so involved in this case and has become very vocal about it is they feel this man basically was betrayed by the Exeter police, that, you know, he did a public service. He was performing for the police, helping them ascertain information from people who didn't speak English and happened to mention that his visa had expired, and he ends up getting reported to ICE by the Exeter police. The ACLU in New Hampshire has said this has become an increasing problem, and they assert that local police departments are not allowed to perform the duties of federal immigration authorities.
So wait, so when you say what part of that is the increasing problem?
That essentially more that with a growing immigration population in New Hampshire, that a number of local police departments, according to the ACLU, are inquiring about the immigration status of people they come in contact with. Hmm. And that in the ACLU's view, that's beyond their authority. They're not supposed to be able to do that. And that's what produced
this
lawsuit.
Issue is, I mean, this is a big issue around the country. It's also playing out here with the border checkpoints.
Right.
There were a number of cases that were just thrown out under the state constitution. So this is kind of a gray area. And certainly ICE has been more active since President Trump was elected. The other interesting aside here is that people often don't realize that one of the biggest sources of people being in the country illegally is overstaying their visas, not coming illegally across the border, coming into the country on some sort of work visa or vacation visa and just staying. And that seems to be the case here.
But this gentleman was married to an American, right? Now, I'm not familiar with the details of immigration law.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what his status was as some, you know, certainly that being married to an American citizen can have an impact on your immigration status, but it doesn't guarantee you citizenship or a green card necessarily. So
no,
I'm not sure
doesn't.
Where he was
right.
in that process.
And that's what you don't know is, for example, in this case, we don't know the answer to this, but had his visa expired prior to getting married a year ago with this woman? If it had, getting married to her wouldn't have changed his status.
Or was he in the queue for a green card? We just don't know.
Exactly.
Yeah, and part of the story, as you mentioned, Kevin, was that the police department, not the relationship the police department has with ICE isn't necessarily one that's on paper like they must report to ICE. But there's also nothing that forbids them from reporting to ICE, correct?
Yeah, well, I mean, this has been a bone of contention. We've had discussions about sanctuary cities around the country where the idea is that local authorities will not explicitly cooperate with immigration enforcement. And so, there's a lot of, I'm not a lawyer, but my sense from reading these issues regularly is that there's a lot of gray area in terms of that cooperative relationship.
You're listening to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Also this week, Dartmouth College has decided to move a set of racially insensitive murals to an off-campus storage facility after complaints from Native American students prompted the creation of a committee to study the issue. Dean, I'll turn to you because you spent a decade at Dartmouth College and you didn't really see these things.
It's
did you?
Interesting, and it's been a while since I was there, but I was trying to rack my brain if I'd ever seen these murals. And in reading about it, it said that they're in they were hanging in an old dining room that is not regularly used anymore. But you can still view these murals. They were painted in the 1930s. They're based on a Dartmouth drinking song of the late 1800s, and they depict Native Americans in various stages of undress and holding books upside down. It's sort of a negative portrayal of Native Americans. And, you know, Dartmouth has a long connection, was an institution set up to in part educate Native Americans. There's a Native American Studies department, and so I guess students or faculty complained that these were insensitive, and they've essentially been put in storage. But that was my recollection. I don't recall seeing them. Because they were in this sort of basement room that had been a dining center, not out in the center of campus necessarily.
Mm-hmm. So they've been moved. But they're not necessarily going to be locked away forever, right, Kevin? I mean, there's
right.
some educational value here
right.
for these things.
They've been put in an off-campus storage facility, and these have been, I guess that's been one of the greater uses of these murals, even though they're in a remote part of campus. A number of classes have toured and viewed these murals in Native American studies courses and other courses about discrimination and profiling of people. So that will continue. Those the Dartmouth administration indicated that teachers will be and students will be free to go to that other location.
Okay. Another thing to talk about before the break, which is that the U.S. Senate held a major hearing on PFAS chemical contamination on Wednesday with testimony from a local advocate. Dean, what prompted this hearing in the first place?
Well, this is actually, I mean, this has been an ongoing concern for New Hampshire, given some of the issues on the seacoast. We've talked about the PFAS issue many times here on the Roundup, and this was Maggie Hassan's Senate subcommittee, and she actually brought Gene Shaheen in as a guest, and they questioned federal regulators for a couple of hours and trying to get a better sense of, you know, how the government is going to move forward to deal with this issue long term in terms of, you know, resources and testing and the kind of program that they're going to have in place and continue to have in place for New Hampshire citizens that have been affected by this chemical in their water.
And Portsmouth resident Andrea Amico, whose family drank contaminated water at Pease International Tradeport, testified at this U.S. Senate hearing. Here she is answering a question from U.S. Senator Maggie Hassan.
Do you think the government is acting in a timely manner to address PFAS contamination across the country?
I do not. I think we need a more consistent approach among the federal agencies.
A more consistent approach among the federal agencies, according to Andrea Amico. One of the problems regarding PFAS, and Annie Ropeek of NHPR has done some fantastic reporting on this, is that PFAS is not just one chemical, right? Like it's a lot of chemicals, and they're not all regulated in the same way, Dean.
I believe it was used in nonstick coating, I think, is my recollection. I've actually seen ads for frying pans where they say up in the corner, PFAS-free. So clearly that was at some point was used as a part of the chemicals for a coating on a pan. And yeah, it's been a slow kind of process to get a handle on just the scope of the problem.
Yeah, and also it's been used a great deal in foam that's used to douse firefighting. Fires that occur,
source,
that's
right.
And that's really one of the biggest sources of the problem at Pease, is essentially had firefighting departments training
right.
out there on the property using this foam, and it leached into the groundwater.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR, and still to come, we're going to be talking about the City of Keene proposal to raise the age, the minimum age for purchasing tobacco products and e-cigarettes. It's a proposal at this point. We'd love to know what you think about this. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or shoot us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Roundup. We'll be right back.
Hey there, it's Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A on NHPR. And as a fan of the show, I wanted to let you know that we are coming to New Hampshire, and you can be part of the conversation. Join me for an evening of fantastic discussion about issues that matter to you and to the Granite State. Join us on Thursday, October 18th at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord. You can get your tickets right now at ccanh.com. See you then.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and Kevin Landrigan, reporter for The Union Leader, and with you. Give us a call. If you have questions or comments about the week's news, now is your chance. 1-800-892-6477. The City of Keene, there's a proposal on the table for raising the legal age for purchasing tobacco products and e-cigarettes from 18 to 21. Dover has already done this. Kevin, the Union Leader's done some reporting on this as well. What are advocates for this proposal hoping to achieve?
Well, essentially, the advocates of of this proposal are, they're certainly concerned about tobacco, but they're more concerned about the e-cigarette component. They studies have shown that that's easily the much more common way that older teens under the age of 21 are starting to smoke is using vaping products, e-cigarettes, believing that they're healthier. The FDA studies certainly haven't confirmed that's the case, and that's why these anti-tobacco groups want to raise the age from 18 to 21, hoping that fewer people will actually start smoking if they can't start until they're in their 20s.
Yeah, and one of the original industry arguments in favor of e-cigarettes was that it would help people get off of traditional cigarettes and cut back on all the tar and the nicotine and all that sort of stuff. But what we've seen instead is an explosive growth in the use of these. You spend any e-cigarettes, spend any time in the vicinity of a high school or on a college campus, and you see the telltale vapor trails, or you see people in the cars puffing on these e-cigarettes. And so it's actually become a very lucrative market, particularly for teenagers. And, a sense is that any pushback here is really coming from local businesses that get a lot of revenue from selling the equipment that you need to keep these e-cigarettes functioning.
Yeah, Kevin, I believe you have reported on, or the union leader has reported on some
right.
of that pushback.
Right. A number of businesses in Keene, of course, as we know, Keene's a college town, so it's got a lot of potential tobacco users between the ages of 18 to 21 at Keene State College. And so a number of the merchants downtown are very much against this. They argue that if you're going to raise the age, you have to do it on a regional basis or on a statewide basis. Otherwise, you're essentially going to force these young people who may be interested in having these products to just leave town and go somewhere and buy them somewhere else and bring them back into the community. You're not really going to accomplish anything other than hurt the local economy. That's their argument.
Mm-hmm. A few more stories to discuss this week. One of them is that state officials announced Wednesday night that they had approved the lease transfer of the Mount Sunapee ski area to Colorado-based Vail Resorts. Kevin, remind us of why this proposed lease transfer was so noteworthy to begin with when it was proposed earlier this year.
Yeah, well, Mount Sunapee, of course, is one of the two state-owned mountains other than Cannon Mountain, and it's a very popular recreational resort. More than 20 years ago, the state signed a 99-year lease with the Muller family, which at the time owned Mount Akemo and also Mount Escutney in Vermont, which were private pretty successful mountains, and so the Mullers were allowed to essentially run the facility for the state and pay the state an annual rental payment. This transaction actually essentially hands the lease terms over to Vail Resorts, which, by the way, also in the transaction, they're actually purchasing Muller's other two resorts in Vermont. Muller's essentially retiring from the business and has divested all his properties to Vail. As folks who follow skiing know, Vail Resorts is one of the preeminent ski management companies in the world. They own a number of resorts, not just in the West, but also some in the East Coast as well. And that's what we're seeing in this transaction, sort of much like we saw with banks in the 90s and the early 2000s. Skiing is a very difficult business to make a profit on. It's seasonal. It's very unpredictable. Even with snowmaking, all it takes is a week to 10 days of very warm weather, and you've got a mountain with grass and rock rather than fake snow. So a number of these owners of private resorts are essentially selling out to these large conglomerates like Vail Resorts.
And is part of the worry that if a lease is transferred, there might be a lot of development, and that might change the character of the region or the mountain or both?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's certainly always been the concern of Friends of Mount Sunapee, the group that originally fought the Mullers from fought this lease from being approved. And the terms of the lease are very restrictive with regard to what the leaseholders can do on the property that isn't developed. Over the years, the Executive Council has amended the lease. They allowed some ski expansion to occur.
Yeah, new lodge. Additional trails. But the issue has always been condominium development and connecting this additional parcel of land where they were there was, I think, in Unity, where there was a concern about development. Yeah, it's the same set of issues, really, that we heard back when the Mullers took over. And so there's always been this tension between the need for economic development in the region there, the Sunapee region, with the people who are concerned about conservation and natural resources.
Obviously important to point out a couple of things. One is one of the first major decisions for the new resources and cultural resources director, Sarah Stewart, who Governor Sununu appointed some months ago to this position, and also Chris Sununu comes from the ski industry, the private ski industry, longtime general manager of Waterville Valley Mountain Resort. So I certainly wasn't surprised the state of New Hampshire looked on this lease in a favorable fashion once they carefully reviewed it.
Let's talk about a few more stories before the end of the hour. One of them is that legalizing marijuana could secure New Hampshire as much as $58 million a year. That's according to a Department of Revenue Administration analysis. And that was the highest estimate so far. I mean, this is, of course, assuming recreational weed is legalized in the state, which is, possibilities, depends on who you ask. And it's currently legal in all the surrounding states, and there's still a lot of unknowns, especially when it comes to the tax rate that the legislators would choose to use if it is legalized. Right, Kevin?
That's right. And this study looked at, sort of piggybacked on a study that the state of New York had done about the impact of legalizing marijuana in that state. And it does find that it would generate a significant amount of revenue, up to $58 million at a 15% tax rate, much less, a little over half of that at a 7% tax rate. That's going to be one of the kind of tricky things New Hampshire will have to deal with once they were to decide to legalize recreational marijuana. You then have to look at the elasticity of the product. If you've got all the surrounding states that have marijuana legal at various tax rates, then how does New Hampshire kind of hit that tax sweet spot? Mm. Much like we do with cigarettes and liquor and other products we sell and compete with neighboring states, we try to price them and tax them at an amount that encourages a lot of out-of-state people to come here and buy them.
It's not only the tax level that will determine the kind of revenue, but the nature of the retail market. Are you going to have cannabis stores connected to the state liquor stores at the highway rest stops, or is it going to be simply you get to have some certain amount for personal cultivation? There's a wide range of ways in which people can access cannabis, and that really has an impact on the nature of the revenue that's generated. Then you have to decide the tax rate.
Mm-hmm. And as part of this, after a year of studying cannabis, Representative Patrick Abrami says his views on whether or not to legalize or the nature of marijuana in general has somewhat evolved. He says he's voted against marijuana bills in the past.
I can see some of the benefits of legalization now. Whether or not I would vote on the floor for it is another discussion.
But nevertheless, his views have evolved. I should pause to say that this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Not sure if Patrick Abrami's evolving views are indicative of a larger change of views, but worth mentioning nonetheless, Dean.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is an issue that is gaining momentum around the country. Public opinion in general has shifted in favor of recreational use, certainly in New Hampshire. where you have majority of people who favor it. But the devil is always in the details. It's not clear to me necessarily that the state legislature is ready to do that. And you think about what an ordeal it was to get the medical marijuana program up and running. Imagine now the much bigger and complex issue of a retail market. I mean, look what's been going on in Massachusetts. It's taken them a long, long time to get the retail market up and running.
Worth mentioning before we hit the last two stories of the hour that Abrami is the state rep and chair of the Study Commission on Marijuana Legalization. A few lighter stories to talk about. This one's kind of a bummer if you're planning on going out apple picking in October. And that's, you know, the Concord Monitor is reporting this week that the abundant squirrel population this year is taking a bite out of local apple orchards. That these squirrels are sort of really feasting on these apples and the and pumpkins and other things. We've reported on the abundance of roadkill this year because it's just been a good year for squirrels. They've had a lot to eat. They've been reproducing like crazy. Now it's going to the apple orchards, and that's no fun for us.
Yeah, it's affecting it. And that's a big part of fall tourism is apple picking and pumpkin patches and all that kind of good stuff. And anybody who drives around the state has seen the carnage on the roads. It's just remarkable in my many years here. I don't recall ever seeing that number of dead squirrels on interstates. From what I've read, there for those of people who are unhappy with Squirrelmageddon or Squirrelpocalypse, Squirrel NATO. I've seen every reference you can NATO apocalypse, Armageddon. That nature has a way of kind of rebalancing the population over time, and that's what naturalists are saying, that over time this will find an equilibrium that isn't quite so large that it's resulting in all this roadkill and damage to commercial crops.
Yeah, well, for what it's worth, I hit an apple orchard last weekend, and there was the trees were heavy. It was very nice. So, last thing to talk about is. I don't know how much people care about this or whether people have even registered, but we learned that Dunkin' Donuts is changing its name to just Dunkin'. So meaningful for either of you gentlemen?
Not especially. I mean, I'm still waiting for KFC to decide that it's economically important to go back to Kentucky Fried. That'll happen at some point in the next 10 or 20 years. But no, I mean, they put a lot of effort into making these kinds of branding changes. It's not something they do lightly, that's for sure. And it's driven by other changes in the retail market for breakfast and lunch food and not just donuts anymore, obviously.
Yeah, I think it's bad news for McDonald's, Burger King. I think Dunkin' Donuts has been an iconic brand. And now by going to Dunkin', they're signaling we're coming right at your market of fast foods. And you see that more and more. With every couple of months, this franchise has been coming up with new and different food items to sell.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. Really appreciate you being here.
Thanks, Peter.
Great to be here.
That's Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader and Dean Spiliotis of SNHU. And all the stories that we talked about today available for your viewing pleasure at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.